Tell me about the stories that you write. Why do you choose to write plays?
Well, not like I always thought I would be a playwright. Like I never, it never even crossed my mind. And I actually didn't start writing until about 2000. And I was doing a little memoir, a little short story. And I was looking for a workshop to go to one summer. And I ended up at this playwriting workshop only because it had a very intriguing premise. I didn't know anything about playwriting. I didn't think I would, you know, it would be my thing, but started on Sunday, and by Wednesday morning, I was like, oh my God, this is so awesome. And so then 4 years later, I finished an MFA in playwriting. But all of my work has something to do with social justice. So my MFA play thesis was about breast cancer and sexist medicine. And I wrote a short play, about 12 or 13 minutes. It's about gender dynamics, like gender and power and turning them around. It has Alice B. Toklas, Gertrude Stein, and Pablo Picasso in it, and the dynamics change from the masculine being and having the power to the feminine. And I mostly write almost exclusively full-length plays.
Full-length plays?
Yeah. So I've written a play about homophobia in college women's sports. I've written a play about hooking up. I've written a play about national politics and national media and sexism and homophobia. It was based on an incident with Rachel Maddow.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a play that I threw out.
Why did you throw it out?
Because it was a bad play. But it had the characters in it, the three major characters, they wouldn't leave me alone, so I wrote another play. And that's about, it's only three characters, and one of them's a trans man. And then, this one I'm moving out. That's bad when you can't remember your own place. I told you about that one. Oh, maybe I got them. So to sort of tie in with your like statistics question, like I can't help myself. Like several people have said to me, like, of all the things you could choose to do, like, you are not going to make a living at this. I'm like, I know that. Like, even Tony Kushner doesn't make a living being a player. But it's just like, I have to.
You have to.
I have to.
And
I can't stop myself.
Yeah, and how do you, I guess with the Rachel Maddow one, it was an incident, so that must have fired you in some way, but for some of the other themes, you know, with homophobia and, you know, college women's sports and things like that, I wanted to know, I guess, more about sort of how those get started into being plays.
Well, I said this at the place I was having the Rachel Maddow play workshop, I guess you could say. This woman wanted to know how to introduce me. And she said, well, what kind of plays do you write? I said, I write about things that piss me off. So the college women's sports piece was instigated by this woman who was a coach of a top NCAA Division I team. Had like 90 wins and 16 losses in 4 years. they were on their way, you know, they won their conference, they were on the NCAA championships
mm-hmm.
where, you know, tournament was about to start. And I saw this article in the New York Times that she was considering resigning. I'm like, this doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then 3 days later, she was gone. And she was basically forced to resign because one of her coaches, who was a friend, went to the university administration and under a rumor that she'd been involved with a former player. Not a current player, a former player. I was bullshit.
Yeah.
I was just out of my mind. So, and now I'm like version 5 of that play. That
wow.
I wrote that about 5 years ago, but I'm reworking it some more and I'm getting. It was, it's got some good response, but it hasn't been taken, so I'm working on it again. The Rachel Maddow play came from when, you might remember this, Scott Brown went after her,
mm-hmm.
and she responded with a full page ad in the New York Times and all that. So his, just the way he treated her in the press, made me crazy. Like, I have a lot of respect for Rachel. I don't watch her show anymore because I feel like she's gotten into this sort of groove that is not pretty. She says the same thing about 8 times, you know, in an hour. And so it's gotten too formulaic for me. But at the time,
right.
So that's where that play came from. And it's called Mad Cow because I went to look at some of what was going on online, you know, and this guy had, I mean, the misogyny was just unbelievable. This guy had written, Rachel Maddow? No, it's Rachel Mad Cow.
Wow.
So I was like, okay. So that's what I titled the play, Mad Cow. The play that I just finished this first draft of, with the trans man in it, that really came about more from, like, sort of what's going on in the media and, you know, people, like, being freaked out, being not freaked out, you know, is it part of the spectrum of being gay, is it, you know, something completely different, what is gender identity? I mean, I just read something today where these women had taken the question of gender identity so far, you could be anything except a straight white man and it would fit in the category. And I'm like, you know, sort of the bending over backwards, almost like, not quite, but close to like bleeding heart liberalism, like we have to include everybody. And I'm like, something in this is, doesn't make sense. But anyway, so I wrote this play where, like, so the trans man is, like, cool, you know, he's figured out his thing, but these, he's, like, 20. But these two women who are, like, 40 are, like, one of them is, like, completely hysterical. She can't, like, deal with him at all. Keeps having fantasies about it and stuff like that.
Mm.
So those are the three characters that were in this play. It defenestrated. So was my word for 2013. So they all have this social justice.
Yeah. And how is playwriting as a writing form, I don't know, how has that influenced the work that you write? Because, I mean, you have these social justice topics in mind, but sort of how does putting them into dialogue, into, you know, action, how does that really change your piece or form your piece? I don't know.
Well, it's a good question. If it wasn't a play, it would probably be a screed. And, you know, people turn off from that. Like, you can preach to the converted, but I mean, some of this sounds really cliche, but it really is about hearts and minds. It's like, or the things that people don't see or that they assume.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think the biggest thing for me is to write a variety of women characters, and all of them powerful in one way or another.
Yeah.
I mean, I am so sick of heterosexual living room plays, I could shoot myself. And, you know, warts and all. So, like, the Rachel Maddow play, the character is cheating on her long-term partner, and, you know, doing all, she has her own thing, she can't really commit, you know.
Yeah.
But she has this national stage and, you know, all this media power and so on. And the hooking up play, that was, I read this article, which I have never been able to find again, about, this was quite a while ago, kids in high school, just making hookup dates. And it so pained me that I had read this play. And the play has a straight white guy is the main character.
Mm.
So it's not like I go in with an idea, like I'm going to write this from this perspective.
Right.
You know, that's sometimes you're at the mercy of the characters.
Yeah.
But he has a best friend. The best friend ends up getting involved with this bisexual waiter. He's never had gay sex before. You know, the straight guy is chasing after this really rich person at the same time as putting moves on a librarian. And, you know, so it's all this stuff about, like, who's zooming who as
mm-hmm.
I mean, this
mm-hmm.
So, but it's much more an exploration of what the power dynamics are and what people are, how real people are willing to be and what kind of circumstances.
Yeah. Which writers do you take inspiration from?
Well, that's not an easy question. There are writers that really inspire me in terms of their command of the form.
Hmm.
So, Harold Pinter, Edward Albee. Lynn Nottage, Adrian Kennedy, who totally twists my mind. But, so they really push me around the craft. You know, those are role models around the craft. In terms of the actual work, I would say it would be a lot of people who might never heard of, but people who keep trying to, you know, do different things. Like, this is kind of funny. I've never seen a Ryan Landry play, but I've read so much about him that I just think he's like this really courageous person and totally creative and, you know, keeps pushing the edge of what it is that he wants to do, and which I think is great. So I think what inspires me more are like exceptional performances and good plays. So, like I saw Cherry Jones in a Brian Friel play.
Oh, wow.
And just, you know, like I still have it in my mind. It's called The Faith Healer. Do you know it?
No.
So there's three characters. One's a con artist, faith healer, his lover, and then I think his manager. So they each have a monologue, like long monologues, 20 monologue. And then there, I think there's just one part where the three of them are together. So her monologue, she comes out, there's a little round table and a chair and a wine glass and a bottle of wine and an ashtray. She comes out, she sits down, she lights a cigarette, she pours a glass of wine, she takes a wine. This is like 3 or 4 minutes. There was not a sound in the theater. Her performance was just so extraordinary.
Uh-huh.
So that inspires me around, you can write a monologue that will completely enrapt people. So that's one of my answers.
Yeah.
Well,
that sounds incredible.
It was just astonishing. She's amazing.
Yeah.
So, I've read a lot. I read for places. So it's really much more the kinds of things that go together. Like, I read Jen Silverman's play, Still. Have you read that?
No.
So, that won the James Chambers Prize a couple of years ago. And it's a woman and a stillborn baby that is the size of like a 6-foot man. It's just an amazing play. And the writing is just so crisp, you know, no extra words. So that's, you know, like that's an experience. Like how you can write that, those two characters.
Yeah.
And have it be completely riveting.
Yeah.
And not pedantic or whatever.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Do you find that you can admire somebody's writing, you know, the people you've mentioned, Lynn Nottage or whoever, by not even seeing it? Like you mentioned with Ryan Landry, you've never seen one of his plays, but you still really admire the writing. How is it different seeing it?
Well, I can't say I admire the writing because I've never read the writing. So,
oh, you've never read the writing?
No. But I know about Gold Dust Orphans. I know.
Okay.
Places where he's performed, like a really pity places. You know, he just had a big thing on Huntington last year. So he really, like, never gave up on his vision, never gave up on himself, you know, kept recreating both his plays and his work.
Yeah.
But I've never read a word.
Oh, okay.
I've read an interview.
Oh, an interview, okay.
But,
Yeah. Do you think women writers tell different stories than men writers?
That's an impossible question because there's what gets published, what's available, what gets performed.
Yeah.
What, you know, a lot of people write to the market. I don't feel like there's a way I can answer that fairly. That's like, you know, trying to say, you know, Hemingway's the greatest writer there ever was. Hemingway was really limited, you know, like his material was very narrow.
Yeah.
Like some of the things he did were great, but...
Are there any writers right now who are discussing gender issues in their work that you admire? If so, sort of how do you view their plays or...
I thought Ruin was a terrific play. Really, really terrific. I thought, you know, all the gender stuff that was in there about, you know, what happens to a woman who is raped, how that, you know, like, I know it's true in other cultures, as well as the Congo there, and who she, like how she protects her women. And one of the women was raped and I believe had a daughter, it's a young daughter. And she's there, but her, like her price is really low, but the madam took her in as a way to save her life, essentially. And I could be a little fuzzy on the details, but that's how I remember it.
Right.
And it, there is some very powerful stuff, and at some point the war comes right into the place. She also has a bar. And, you know, I thought she, somebody today, we were talking about how, like, language is... I think I can say this to you, perverted by the dominant culture, male culture, to keep women from their power. In this particular case, we were talking about the word feminism or feminist.
Yeah.
But you can take that same thing in so many different places and in so many different cultures that the things that enable women to be powerful are degraded and associated with being degraded.
Yeah.
So that women are taught not to want them because then they will get married, not be poor, be able to eat, you know, have family connections and things.
Yeah, no, it, that just made me think about, I guess when I first started writing plays and characters, sort of like if you wanted, I don't know, this was never conscious, but it, I guess it's now that I realize it, you know, if you're thinking about a successful woman, like, well, what are the issues that she's facing? And I feel like there's so many times that a woman will be written as overly, you know, overly businesslike to the point where she's a bitch, which is, no one would ever say that about a man in the same position, you know, and it's just because she has... the power, like that extra power, that she's given these labels,
or they would call a man a prick or a bastard,
right?
But that has some admiration factor. Like, wow, he's such a prick. Do you see how he handled, like, blah blah blah? You know. So yeah, I agree with you.
It's just it's really fascinating that, you know, when you think about, oh, well, characters can't be perfect, they have to have a flaw, but for some reason it seems that the flaw that people will give a successful woman is being selfish or bitchy or something like that, in which...
Or manipulative.
Manipulative.
Or whiny.
Exactly.
Or castrating.
I think that's just fascinating, though. Yeah.
I'm glad you're fascinated. I'm still horrified.
I'm horrified and fascinated. How would you define a strong woman character? Is it important for you to write strong woman characters? If so, why?
Voice, agency, action.
Voice, agency, action.
My partner was a women's studies professor, so it's a little drilled into my head, but it's when you think about what those words mean, that's really what it's about.
So voice meaning that she...
speaks up, speaks for herself, doesn't whisper, yells when necessary, talks about things that need to be talked about. You know, all the different, not just the physiological, but all the things that voice means.
Yeah. But voice and action are interesting because it's when have you spoken so much that you need to act, I guess. Have you, I don't know, if you...
You have to act all the time.
You have to act all the time?
All the time. Like, that's being alive.
Yeah.
It's taking action, saying what you need to say, going where you need to go.
Yeah.
Speaking up.
Yeah.
It's being like full human from the inside out, you know, and like if they're barriers, you either trample them or you figure out how to get around them. But,
you're still like moving. You're still trying
yeah,
to, you know.
Yeah. It's what being alive is.
Yeah. Have you ever started writing a play and the gender of a main character changed during your writing process?
When I wrote the play about hooking up, I intentionally wrote it with no pronouns. Because I wanted to see what would happen. Like, so I would write dialogue and I would think to myself now, would only a man say this? Or would only a woman say this? Or only a, you know, whatever. How many things went in there. So, and there were no pronouns in the entire play.
That's amazing.
A full-length play. It got stilted in places, but it was a really important thing. And even if I had thought, like the opening scene of these two characters walking down the street, talking to each other. And when the scene came to me, I sort of thought about it as being two guys, but I didn't necessarily want, I didn't know what I was writing, I just had this like image.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't want it to define whatever was going to come afterwards because I didn't know what was going to come after.
Yeah.
So, it's probably the only play I've written that has more male characters than female. There's three men and two women.
I mean, that sounds like a great writing exercise for anybody to try, because I feel like that's something that I hear a lot is somebody's reading, you know, a draft of a script and they say, oh, a man wouldn't say this, but that's a very gendered way of thinking, oh, well, a man couldn't.
Yeah, well, what kind of man?
Yeah, exactly.
A
what
white
kind of
man in America, a
yeah.
Republican man, you know.
Yeah.
A man in Cape Town, or, you know, of Indian descent. I mean, what, you know, who are you talking about?
Exactly. And
you know, culture makes huge difference.
So, how did you finally decide what gender those characters were going to be?
Well, I don't exactly know when that happened. But at some point, I got really interested, and I think this partly came out of not using any pronoun, is I became interested in the sexual preference aspects as well. So like one of the men is straight and ends up being seduced by this kind of almost emotionally stalking or sexually stalking guy who's a waiter, who sort of draws him in, and then after the guy falls for him, then he gets like, it's no big deal. It's like, you know, go back to your life. So I was trying to play with very different kinds of people. So, like, the librarian is not your you know, glasses librarian. But both women happen to be straight. It's not like that's what I planned. So there are things about class in there. How sexy is wealth and power. Do you go for that instead of going for like somebody who maybe gets in your face but is asking to really know you? Probably somewhere after the first draft, I was like, well, if I want to explore these other things, I'm going to have to decide.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to leave it up to the audience to decide.
Right.
Or the casting director. Plays have really come as, you know, like the characters have in a lot of ways come first. But like the basketball play is, I would say, 2/3 people of color, because that's how it started. It was about a black coach in the South. So then I put in things of somebody from the, a white kid from the Midwest who gets recruited by her, and then some of the racial dynamics that happen in the school. And so some, it differs.
Yeah.
You know, sort of depending on the genesis of the play.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. If or when during the writing process do you start thinking about the audience, do you feel that you write for a certain audience?
Well, I think most writers, well, I don't know about if this is true, but I know some writers write for a particular person. And I don't write for a particular person, but my partner, in addition to being a professor, has written 3 books, short stories, memoir, feminist pedagogy. She's a performance artist. She's written 4 full-length performance pieces, a bunch of short plays. Has, in terms of writing, I've learned more from her than anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had some really good teachers, but she really is a phenomenal writer. So she comes in my head a lot because I'm like, no, you can't say this, Jill would have a fit. Like, say it a different way. Just that's very lazy writing. So, you know, like I have like 4 adverbs and they're most, I think they're all in the stage directions. So in terms of craft, yeah, all the different parts, plot, character, arc, whatever. I read to her. But not like I wanna, you know, like she needs to like this or anything like that, but just like, you know, I can't be lazy or whatever. Or if I am, like I have an idea and I wanna write down the idea, I don't draw a chart for her. Mm. It's like, no, not ready, can't. I might not even talk about it. In terms of everybody else, like, that imagined audience. I would say I write for people who like to think and think about new things and be stimulated. And their joy in entertainment comes from that.
Yeah.
You know, like a really good meal. It pleases you on many different dimensions. Sight, taste, color.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you ever want to make them feel challenged in their views or uncomfortable at all? Or, I mean, because you want to make them think.
Right.
So, I don't know.
Well, of course challenged. Uncomfortable that I think early in my writing, you know, like it was, I'm gonna make you sit up and pay attention and you're gonna learn something. And people actually don't respond to that very well, and the writing gets, you know, like cliched, strained, many, many bad words. Like some of the ones they use for women, whiny, bitchy, you know. So what I want to do now with my audience is to have them on the edge of their seat. Like, not in panic or terror, but leaning forward, like,
great.
Being really drawn in, and not noticing the time, or, you know, just to be so involved. What's going on.
Yeah.
So that's who I write for. And I also, I'm an audience. Like, when I read my own work to myself, like, I now know, like, oh, this is flat, this is boring. Okay, you can fix it later, but don't pretend like you don't know there's a problem here.
Has it taken a long time to develop that kind of self?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I would say in the, probably the last year now, I have a really good sense. Sometimes I can't do anything about it. Like, I have to have somebody else read it, or have a reading in the house, or something like that, so that I can hear it out loud and hear what other people say. But I had early 2014, last summer, I took a class with it taught me some things about language and writing, or I learned them, which didn't necessarily teach me, that, like, you know, did, like, the step function, you know, like, we just went to a whole other level in my work, so it's a lot harder to, like, good enough go by.
Yeah.
No. So that was a big change.
Yeah.
Working with her. Do you know her work at all?
I know her name, and I know that she was the original Angel, and I've definitely heard her name, and I can't remember any of the work that she's written right now.
She does a lot of adaptations of Greek plays.
Oh, okay.
And just, I heard her perform on it. It's just amazing. It's about Penelope and Odysseus. And it was like, she goes back. So, you've been gone for 21 years. You think I'm going to, like, just welcome you with open arms? I mean, it would be like that. It was just terrific. But she wrote this play called Tongue of a Bird.
That, I've read that. That's why I knew it.
And, I mean, if you really study that,
yeah.
Every single word does something.
Yeah.
Just, and, you know, has a linear story, has several non-linear stories, has all of these, you know, different universes brought in.
Yeah.
It's a stupendous piece of work.
If I remember correctly, I mean, it shifts dramatically from a very poetic, more, I mean, I don't want to, it's not monologues because they are conversing, but it seems more internal, and then it goes to action,
right?
Okay, so I am thinking of the right play.
Yeah. And then has a ghost. I mean, she just works on all these things. I actually, when I had this workshop with her, I interviewed her about the play, because they did it in Watertown at the Rep, and they asked me to, if I wanted to write the notes. And it took her 8 years to write that. And it came out of this recurring dream that she had. So it's just fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, what people do. But I think, I've read it like 4 or 5 times and keep finding new things and more things, like how many times she uses the word black or white, or the image of a rope, or the other thing. I mean, it's just a phenomenal piece of work. So.
Yeah. What kind of theater do you think, I guess we already talked about this a lot, but what kind of theater do you think is the easiest to get produced? Do you ever feel pressured to create plays that fit in with this mold?
I would be so angry if I were to play. I would be gnashing my teeth.
Mm.
I think there's a little change, but I think mostly if you write plays that really move you, so are we live? Are we happening?
Are there characters or plays that you still haven't found a place for? Are there outside forces that have prevented you from writing these characters or plays?
Yes. There are two. to basically both my parents.
Wow, interesting.
My father was killed in an accident when my mother was pregnant. And she was 4 months pregnant. And he was the love of her life, and like all sorts of things. And I look exactly like him. And I'm shorter than him, but I have very similar body type, mesomorphic. Long legs, and I do my faces exactly the same. And my mother and I had a very difficult relationship. Like, it wasn't until she died that I realized I was afraid for my whole life. And I had an older brother, half brother, different fathers. So there was a way in which my relationship with my mother, I was like, she wanted me to be like her, very femme, housewife, upper class culture, housewife. That was never my thing. So I've thought for a long time about writing a play about my father and I, like imagining him and what our relationship. So that's one.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one was, so my mother had 4 husbands. She was really spoiled. She went to finishing school. She was interested in the theater. She wanted to have a theater. Then the war, World War II started. She married my brother's father because my father wouldn't marry her and leave her a war widow, so she went and married somebody else. Then she divorced him and married my father, and then he died. Then she married his best friend from the army, who adopted us. Then she divorced him, and then 4 years later she married the last guy who was like really not a people person. So it was really both my brother. She was very, I wouldn't say narcissistic, but definitely self-centered. But she came out of that whole 40s thing, So I have thought about writing about her, but she died 3 years ago, and it's just not there.
Yeah.
But those are the only plays of, like, sort of, there are pieces carrying around in my head, but I don't have like a plot or whatever to do. But those are the ones I thought, like, maybe. No, I might have to get a lot older first or more distant.
So.
Yeah.
This is a hard question, and I've been putting it at the end of every interview just to sort of see what sparks people's thoughts, but what would gender parity in the theater look like to you?
The simplest answer, we wouldn't have to talk about it.
It's a good answer. Yeah.
That's what it would look like.
Yeah.
I think I read something the other day. It might even have been in this piece I just read. Like, America is totally obsessed with categories.
Yeah.
And I'm like, gender parity, class, race, all the different parities, equalities, we shouldn't even have to talk about it.
Yeah.
That's the one I want. Like, that's such a play. Oh. It only has people under 7 in it? Oh, that's really interesting. I mean, it should be a really great play.
Yeah.
And that's the art, part should move. And all the other stuff, there should be enough of it that you don't have to say, okay, well, let's see. three men, four white people. Oh, I have to change how I write this character because, you know, it's not right.
Yeah.
But that might be how the play comes to me.
So how do we move forward? Because, I mean, this is the hard part. I'm doing this because I want to hear what people have to say. But I am terrified that because I've chosen to use the words gender parody, that, you know, instantaneously somebody could ruin it by just saying, well, what is gender? And obviously I'm very aware of that, but it's like you can't overwhelm yourself at the same time being, well, what is gender? How am I supposed to, you know what I mean? Like, I need to ask these questions somehow, but I don't really know how to, you know, I just don't know how to frame it yet because there's so much that we need to do.
Right. You could say that about a lot of things.
Exactly.
Politics, healthcare, you know, environment.
Yeah.
I would say probably the best thing I could say about it is don't write to the critic.
Mm-hmm.
Write your voice, your action. Write your story. Write what really moves you, whether in a good way or a bad way. Be honest. Go for broke. And, I mean, the gender parity in the theater, there are so... This is one of the delights, but one of the huge problems about theater. It's like you can't do it by yourself. It's not like you write a book and you send it to an editor and you get published or not. You need, like, at least six other people.
Yeah.
To, you know, and that's only if you have, like, a two-character play. You know, you need a director, you need a stage manager, you need somebody to do publicity, somebody to handle the money, you know. It's like, you can't do this.
Yeah, it's a collaborative.
By yourself. So that makes it very hard.
Yeah.
So you just have to, like...
Because, I don't know, I was reading an article, I think, I forget exactly where it was from, that because of the Kilroy's list, somebody said, well, wait, I mean, has 50-50 by 2020 failed if people are already, you know, and I said, well, no, I mean, it's still going, you know, how can we say it failed already? If we're saying it failed already, then what chance do we have to keep going, you know?
But it's not the next new thing.
Yeah.
Now the Kilroy's
now
are
the
next
Kilroy's,
new thing.
Yeah.
And I'm like, all of a sudden, like, why does the New York Times care about the Kilroy's? You know,
yeah.
I mean, it's great what they did, and I'm glad people are talking about it, but who's going to be next? You know, there'll be somebody else to like, oh, no, the new great late night host is this one, not that one.
Yeah.
So, you know, I have, don't get me started. I just like, start going off about capitalism in America. Anyway. But there's all these things that have to change.
Yeah.
And in some ways, you know, the worst part is who has the purse strings. Like, right, more women have money now, but all of the sexist things of, you know, wanting to make sure they keep their husbands, you know, they don't have voice, action, agency, except as defined by what is going to help them stay in their relationship. So, and that's a very broad generalization, but, you know, stereotypes come from real things.
Yeah.
So, you have to pick your path and do it no matter what. And encourage other people to say, no, this is good. You know, like, if you really need $100,000 a year, don't depend on your play writing for that, but don't give up on your play writing. Like, go make your money and then come home and write. You know? So, you know, also in America, we have a culture that reserves the arts for the rich. You know, Europe. Countries have a very different orientation toward the arts. South America, very different. Like, the arts are part of you know, the culture, they're part of politics, you know. So, you know, how much time do you have? You know, we could talk about these things all the time, but, yeah. 50-50 in 2020. 2020 is 6 years away. We're still at 17%
yeah.
of women players. We get to 50-50 in 2020, I will be like, I will take you out to dinner. I will throw a party in your honor. I will do whatever because, you know, many people have been working at this a long time.
Yeah.
A long time. And just actually, I'm a member of the International Center for Women Players, which has a great listserv. And somebody posted about, I forget exactly where she's, Memphis maybe, and I've gotten a play produced. And, you know, yeah, a lot of things are not happening for women in a lot of places, but this would happen. And somebody wrote a comment, and that I was just like, couldn't control myself. There was in the New York Times in the art section, they had this little commercial section called Arts Briefly, like what's happening. So there was like this piece about this off-Broadway theater that's been going, theater company that's been going on for 20 years. And they announced their 2014 and 2015 tour. Okay. Three plays, all by men, one woman director. One of the plays is about two secretaries fighting over their boss's pension. I'm like,
oh God.
It's still the 1940s.
Yeah.
You know? Like, after everything, how can you design a season like that?
Yeah.
A 20-year theater.
Yeah.
What else would you like me to rant about?
I like hearing what people have to say. I guess the one, I guess, if you, you know, we're in this gender parity task force, and what, like we were saying, we can't do everything that we have on a list, but what are the main things that you right now think we need to do? They could be tiny, tiny things, but something that just you feel like would actually make a big difference.
Well, I was both encouraged and discouraged.
By the meetings?
Or by the meeting, the Monday meeting. Because I was part of the second and third meetings that led up to the reporting and led up to there being a task force at all. And there were, let's see, 15 to 20% people of color there. There were several deaf activists there. People at there was a critic there. Somebody was there from Company One. There were, you know, like all kind of like, it really was, you know, just theatrically more diverse. And so to be in a meeting where 23 of the 25 people are women and we're all white, this is kind of not what I had in mind.
Yeah.
So partly I think it was a terrible time to get, like the other meetings were like Mondays at 6 o'clock, like people could come after work. A lot of people can't, like, you know, leave work for half a day, particularly on a Monday.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, that sort of worked against to be much diversity there. And also possibly numbers, I think, more people might come. I feel like, you know, the data stuff, the statistics stuff, I think that's really tangible. People get there, hands around it, have things to do. I don't think that's going to change anything. Yeah, I think the much harder work is visibility, getting more plays out, you know, the whole production side, money.
Mm-hmm.
I just talked to somebody who said, we were talking about production, and I said, so, what would you ballpark a production? Like, if you were going to add production to your season, what would it cost? So, said for a 4-character play, $30,000, and $40,000 would be better. So, you just think about that. And, you know, there are plenty of people in Boston who could pony up $30,000 or $40,000. You know,
yeah.
We know this, but they're not doing it for theater. I think, you know, and if most of those people are white men, then, you know, we have a big problem. So, but I think visibility is hugely important, and I think more really good work has to be produced.
Yeah.
Or at least have meetings or workshops.
Mm-hmm.
Or fringe festival or something. Like, people have to go, oh, let's do more of this.
Yeah, it has to have that realization.
Yeah, I mean, how many times can you do, like, Oklahoma?
Yeah.
Okay, we can all sing it too. So, like, gonna sit around the campfire and do Oklahoma.
Yeah.
So, but it's gotten further than anything else. But we're still just talking.
Yeah.
So, when do we get to the doing part? So, this is like we need a Saul Alinsky. You know that song, Alinsky?
Mm-hmm.
So, you need some radical action that makes people go, okay, yeah, I'm going to do something different, otherwise you're going to come and fart in my theater. And that will really drive people away. So, what do you need? What do you need? Yes, I'll do this.
Thank you. Yeah.